Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hello and welcome to the Robots Podcast, episode 153. I am Jana, and today we'll be hearing about termite-inspired robots and their use in construction. But first, let's get the latest news and developments in robotics from Christine.
Thank you, Jana. First, the latest news in soft-bodied robots created by a team of engineers of the Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory CSIL at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. The team, comprised of Daniela Russ, Professor of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science and Director of CSIL, Cactus Onal, Assistant Professor of Mechanical Engineering at the Worcester Polytechnic Institute, and Andrew Marchese, a doctoral candidate in engineering at MIT, created the robot to be autonomous. This means it has all the necessary sensing, actuation, and computation on board. Its flexible body is made of silicon rubber. The robot fish is able to swish from side to side as onboard gas inflates and deflates different parts of its body. This means that the robot is flexible and can maneuver like a real fish, making a full C-turn with its body in just 100 milliseconds. On October 8, 2016, Zurich, Switzerland will host the Cybathlon, a championship for athletes using robotic assistive devices. The competitions are comprised by different disciplines that apply the most modern powered knee prosthesis, wearable arm prosthesis, powered exoskeletons, powered wheelchairs, electrically stimulated muscles, and novel brain-computer interfaces. The assistive devices can include commercially available products provided by companies, but also prototypes developed by research labs. This event will open up athletics to individuals who had previously been barred by the rules governing prosthetics in international sport. Register to become a pilot or technological team and learn all the details on the Cybathlon website or see the Cybathlon's Facebook for regular updates. For more information on robotic competitions and soft-bodied robots, visit robohub.org.
Justin Werfel, who works at the WIS Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering at Harvard University, is first author of a recently published science paper entitled Designing Collective Behavior in a Termite-Inspired Robot Construction Team. Together with his colleagues Kirsten Petersen and Radhika Nagpal, he designed a multi-agent construction system inspired by mound-building termites. These robots use local sensing and coordinate their activity via a shared environment in order to build a specified structure. Justin spoke to our interviewer about the team's work and its potential future applications.
Hi, Justin. Welcome to Robots.
Thanks very much.
Can you start by introducing yourself to our listeners?
So my name is Justin Werfel. I'm a research scientist at Harvard's WIS Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering. And I work on a lot of different kinds of problems in complex systems, on systems of large numbers of independent components, where through their collective actions, some interesting new collective behavior emerges that you might not have expected by studying the components in isolation.
And your latest science paper was about that. Congratulations, by the way.
Thanks so much.
What was this paper about?
So we set out to design a system where you could ask a group of robots to build you something specific you wanted them to build, and they would go and do it automatically. And they do it in a way that's more like the way that insects act than the way that robots normally act. So rather than having a lot of pre-planning, rather than having a central system that figures out exactly what it's going to do in advance, you've got a large number of independent agents all sort of going around doing their own thing. They don't know what the other ones are doing. They don't know anything more than they can see themselves with limited sensing. But together they wind up building the thing that you asked them for.
And why is this a difficult problem?
So there are two different kinds of challenges that we face. So there's algorithmic challenges, and there's hardware ones, right? And we really tried to bridge that whole spectrum in this paper. The algorithmic challenges are based in part on the variability that you wind up getting with this kind of system. So you don't know in advance how many robots there are going to be. The number of robots might change. Some of them might break midway through. You might decide to add some more. The robots don't know what the other ones are doing. They have limited information. The order in which they end up doing things may be different from one run to another. You don't know what the timing of their actions is going to be like. And so despite this kind of decentralized control, this limited information and this variability, the algorithms have to be able to cope with all of those uncertain elements in advance and still wind up producing together the collective thing that you asked for. And it winds up being a case of trying to design a complex system, right? So in general, in complex systems, the key challenge is in connecting the low-level agent behavior and the high-level group behavior. And in general, there's no way of looking at a low-level set of agent rules and predicting what the high-level collective behavior is going to turn out to be. And in this case, we're actually demanding a particular collective result, and we have to come up with a set of low-level rules that's guaranteed to produce that particular result. So those are the algorithmic challenges.
So you have to back out these low-level rules that give rise to this structure that you want to build. And you guys have taken inspiration from termites. Can you tell us what the termites do and how that's an inspiration for you?
Yeah, so termite colonies have millions of independent insects that together build these incredible structures. So termites are on the scale of a centimeter. They're all acting independently. You know, no termite knows what the other ones are doing. They've got limited information, local sensing. They can only tell what's going on right around themselves. They don't know how many other termites there are. They don't know what the other ones are doing. They don't know what the mound looks like any further than they can sense themselves in a very limited way. I mean, termites are blind. And they wind up building these tremendous, complicated mounds. I mean, the tallest on record is 42 feet high. And it's got all kinds of complicated... These mounds in general have all kinds of complicated internal architecture. And somehow they wind up building these things just through these huge numbers of independent agents all going around doing their thing. And so the inspiration we took from that, first of all, that showed us that it could be done. You know, that large numbers of independent agents with limited information can together build large-scale complex structures. And we said, fantastic, that, you know, that shows it is possible. So how could we do it? But not so much how could we mimic the termites into creating structures that... into creating more termite mounds. I mean, we have about as many termite mounds as we need already. We wanted to create a system where you could ask for any structure you want and have the robots follow rules that wind up guaranteeing that structure.
So how do you go from the structure to the actual rules? What's the algorithm behind this?
So the inspiration that we took from termites was not to mimic the details of exactly what they did or how to do it. So the approach we took, the robots, like the termites, are independent. So each one is controlled on its own. It has its own brain. It doesn't know what the others are doing. It's got local sensing, local information, and limited onboard sensing. So all it can tell is what it itself can see with its own sensors. And we tried to keep it very simple, so the robots actually have only three motors to get around and manipulate building material, and only a few simple sensors. So, for instance, they have infrared sensors that amount to sort of a 6-pixel camera, right? We took this approach, also for the termite inspiration, we took this approach where, rather than planning what they were going to do in detail, the robots instead are going around and reacting to different situations they encounter and deciding what to do based on responding to what they see. And the way that they coordinate their actions, and this is a big tool that we drew from termites, is rather than one talking to another one directly, we have them coordinating their activity by manipulating their shared environment. So one will put down some material. Another one comes along later and perceives that material there and reacts to it and uses that to help it decide whether to put down more material in the same place.
Do we really understand the rules of stigmergy? Stigmergy is the thing you're talking about where you modify the environment. In termites, or is that something where the inspiration is really more, this is how it works more or less, and then we're trying to do something similar with the robots.
This is the inspiration from termites, but the details of what the termites are doing are very different from the details of what the robots are doing. One of the reasons for that is that the termites and the robots really have different goals. So termites are not trying to build the same mound every time. Every termite mound is different. Right? They're trying to build a mound that works for the colony in the place where the colony is. For human construction projects, typically we start with a blueprint, and we want to get that structure. You know, if we gave a blueprint to a contractor and they built a building that was not quite what we asked for, but sort of similar, you know, we'd be upset. So for it to be relevant to human construction projects, we want to be able to give the system a picture of the result we want and have a guarantee of building that thing. And so the details of what the robots do are very different from the details of what termites do. One reason is because they have that different goal. Another reason is because the robots can't do all the things that termites can do. We're doing it bio-inspiration rather than bio-mimicry. We're getting ideas from nature, but not trying to reproduce them exactly. And another reason is that in a lot of ways, the real details of what individual termites do are not very well understood.
So tell us a little bit more about the algorithm itself. The robots get this picture. What do they do from there?
So you give the picture to the system as a whole before construction starts. And there's an offline step where a single compiler takes that blueprint and marks it up. It annotates it with essentially with traffic laws. It puts down one-way signs everywhere in the workspace where material's supposed to go. So that acts as a set of traffic laws that tell robots how they're allowed to move through the workspace. They may still have a fair amount of flexibility in how they can do it, but from any place, there's some number of... They have one-way signs that tell them which way they can go and which ways they can't go. So every robot gets a copy of that blueprint, that marked-up building plan. So that that representation, which in the paper we've called a struct path representation, that's going to be specific to the particular structure that you've asked them for. And then there's a single set of rules that all robots follow no matter what they're trying to build. And that tells them essentially how to move through the workspace while following these traffic laws, how to get more material and bring it to different places through the workspace, through the structure they're trying to build. The most important part of that is the set of safety checks that they follow before they attach material any place they're thinking about putting it. Because if they just attached material carelessly, any place where they could put it, where it was eventually supposed to go, but with no attention to the order in which material was being added, it would be very easy for them to build the structure into a state that they couldn't keep building. So for instance, the robots can't climb up or down higher than one step. So you can imagine it would be easy for robots to build a cliff that they can't get past anymore. That would interfere with their movement. It would be difficult to force one brick directly in between two others. You know, human bricklayers, when they lay a line of bricks, they do it, you know, from one point in one direction. They don't skip around, because at some point you'd wind up with a situation where you can't stick a brick between two others. And if that's hard for humans, it's all that much harder for simple robots. So before a robot decides to attach material someplace, it looks at the local neighborhood of bricks. It looks at where there are bricks and where there aren't and where they're supposed to be, and makes sure that a set of conditions is satisfied in that local neighborhood. And as long as all the robots are following those rules, that lets you guarantee certain things about the way that construction will take place, so that you can prove that the robots will never end up building the structure into a situation that they can't deal with. So the process will never get stalled. It'll always be able to keep moving forward until the thing you asked for is finished.
And just to bring home the message about why this is decentralized, can you tell us why?
So every robot is deciding for itself what to do. So they all know the final structure that they're trying to build, but they have no sense of how it's being put together or how much of it is already assembled. every robot is free to wander through the workspace consistent with the struct path, consistent with the traffic laws, any way it likes. And there's many different paths it could take and many different ways the structure could wind up getting built. Each robot is just responding to what it encounters. The rest of the robots are doing the same thing, but the way in which the structure emerges from all of their actions can be very different from one example of the same construction process to the next. Where if you ask the group of robots for the same structure twice, you'll get the same structure both times, but the way it's built could be very different the two times.
What are some of the advantages of building in that way rather than using a centralized approach?
So one advantage of a decentralized approach is it can be robust to the loss of individual components. So if some of the robots break midway through a construction process, it doesn't matter to the rest of them. Nothing that any of them are doing depends on what the others are doing or how many of them there are. So the remaining robots can keep doing exactly the same thing they've been doing and finish the job. You know, a centralized system could also cope with the loss of individual components, but at minimum it would have to stop and replan. And if the central controller were to fail, that would break the entire system, whereas in a really decentralized system, there is no single point of failure that can take the whole thing down. There's also potential advantage in scalability. So the potentially, if you have a big job and you want to get it done faster, you can do that just by adding more robots to it. And again, you don't have to reprogram what any of them are doing. The programming is the same no matter how many there are. Potentially, in a centralized system, the central controller could be a bottleneck. There's a limit to how much it can coordinate at the same time. Maybe it's fine with 1,000 robots, maybe it can't deal with 10,000 robots all at the same time. Whether you want to choose a decentralized or a centralized approach is going to depend on things like the application. So one of the advantages that a centralized system can have is that it can be more efficient. You know, a single brain controlling everything can really plan in advance exactly what the optimal way is to move all the robots around and to move building material around. Whereas, you know, you look at an anthill and you see a lot of activity. You know, you see a lot of insects running around doing things that are not necessarily all focused on a goal. And there can be a lot of unnecessary motion. So the same kind of idea with this decentralized system, you may have some robots taking actions that aren't strictly necessary, going down paths where there winds up actually not being anything for them to do, and they wind up having wasted a trip. So in every case, there are trade-offs. So the long-term vision for this kind of system is that someday robots, you know, not the robots we've shown in this paper, of course, but robots like these may one day be able to build in situations where we can't easily go and build ourselves. So if we want to build underwater research stations, if we want to send astronauts to Mars, those are places where it's very dangerous and very expensive to send people. And so if we could send a team of robots to Mars to build a habitat to wait for the human astronauts to show up later, you know, that's an advantage in trying to start that project. So the kinds of environments where we want to use robots rather than people are the ones where, you know, the classic 3Ds of robotics, dirty, dangerous, and dull. And in particular, if it's a dangerous situation, it might be dangerous for the robots as well. So if you have a system where you're expecting to lose robots, the decentralized approach might be particularly well-suited because the approach is robust to losing some robots. The rest can go on and finish the job without needing to stop and replan or to change anything they're doing.
So what do your robots look like today?
They've been compared to beetles, I guess.
They do look like beetles, yeah. I guess. Yeah,
sort of very, very large, deliberate, slow-moving beetles. They're not, I think, what you would think of if you thought robot. You know, they have a sort of biological look to them. Kirsten Peterson is the robot designer, and she has a phenomenal eye for design in addition to the tremendous work she's done on getting the hardware to work. They're really appealing to look at and to watch.
They're very cute.
Yeah, you sort of want to pick them up and
yes.
Cuddle them. Well, I mean, we do. Mm-hmm. Not everyone, probably.
Sure.
Watching them, they move very slowly, and that's on purpose. They're actually... they're capable of moving much faster, but they're doing everything very slowly and, as I said, very deliberately to make sure that they get things right. So we take an approach where rather than try to prevent any errors ever from occurring, we give them enough feedback to recognize when they're making errors and let them recognize and compensate for that.
These are errors in placing the bricks?
All kinds of errors. If you watch them, they actually make errors constantly. So things like as they try to climb up a step, they slip. They fall back down. They don't actually make it up on their first try. They try to pick up a brick, and the gripper misses the handle and bumps into it, and they don't manage to pick it up on their first try. So they've got feedback like touch sensors in the gripper to be able to tell if they're holding a brick correctly. And if they don't manage to do it the first time, they can tell, and they can try again, and they can keep trying different things until they've succeeded in whatever it was they were trying to do. So that's how they recognize and correct sort of small-scale errors. They could also make much larger-scale errors that they couldn't so easily recover from. So, for instance, if a robot fell off the structure and landed on its back, you know, if a robot broke down in the middle of a thoroughfare, you know, it would have to be cleared away to stop acting as an obstacle to the rest of the robots. And those are the kinds of higher-level errors that our system actually doesn't currently deal with. That's one of the challenges that we'd need to address in extending this from the laboratory system that we've demonstrated to a real-world production system that was meant to be completely autonomous. You would need the system to be able to recognize all of the things that could possibly go wrong, because even if any of those kinds of error modes is very rare, if you have a large enough system, you're trying to build a big enough thing with enough robots, anything that could happen occasionally will happen, and so the system needs to be able to deal with it. And so that's a direction that we would need to address to take this the final step to reality.
All right, but what are some of the sensors, the actuators? You mentioned the grippers, you mentioned the 6-pixel camera. Maybe just give us, you know, an image of what this robot looks like, a bit more exactly.
So the robot has 3 motors. There's one that runs the left 2 wegs, one that runs the right 2 wegs. And I say wegs, there's the robot is using this sort of combination of wheels and legs that Case Western coined the word wegs for that. They look sort of like little pinwheels. And the idea is that wheels are great for roads, for smooth surfaces. They're not so effective on rough terrain and for things like climbing, whereas legs are great for those kinds of things, but they're very complicated to operate. So if, in a sense, you stick legs around the outside of a wheel and just drive the wheel forward, it gives you some of the advantages of both. So there's one motor that runs the left 2 wegs, one that runs the right 2. And that lets the robot move forward and backward and turn in place. And there's a third motor that controls the gripper that it uses to lift blocks up and put them back down. There are 4 kinds of sensors. It has 6 active infrared sensors on the bottom that let it detect patterns of black and white as it moves over them with this very low resolution. There's also a 7th infrared sensor that lets it recognize if it's about to walk over the edge of a cliff. There are touch sensors on the gripper, so it can tell whether it's holding a brick or not. There's a tilt sensor, so it can tell whether it's climbing up or down or moving on the level. And the robots also have ultrasound sensors, sonar rangefinders that they use to walk around the outside of a structure, and that also lets them hear if there's another robot nearby.
All right, and how many robots did you have, and what were they able to build?
We demonstrated 3 robots, all building simultaneously and independently. And we have them building a couple of small structures as demonstrations. There's one where they're finishing off a large structure. It looks something like a castle. So if you look at the supplementary material in the paper, you'll see a video of 3 robots working on this castle. They started with it mostly complete, and you see them finish it off. And then there's another example where they build sort of a trident-shaped structure from scratch. We give them the seed that marks where they're supposed to start and keep supplying them with new bricks, and they go and they build the entire thing by themselves. And that one involves adding 8 bricks among the 3 robots, which takes about half an hour in total.
And what are the next steps for you guys?
We're actually interested in going back to the termites that inspired the work in the first place and studying those in more detail. So the details of what the robots are doing, again, are not that close to the details of what real termites do. And, you know, for all these reasons, like they're trying to accomplish different things and so on. But we actually want to go back and study the termites in more detail and better understand what program it is, in effect, that the termites are running and try to understand how to connect that to the collective structures that their colonies build, again, to better understand sort of how this process of emergence occurs and how to connect the behavior of the high and low levels.
And I know you guys have been to observe actual termite mounds. What does it take to do such a cross-disciplinary project?
So a couple of years ago, when we were well into this robot project, we actually started collaborating with a termite biologist, an expert on the physiology of the termites and their mounds, Scott Turner at SUNY ESF. And he invited us out to his research site in Namibia, which was this phenomenal experience.
Like, I saw the pictures. It looked amazing.
It was amazing, yeah. We got to go and pretend to be field biologists, right? And really experience what it was like to do experiments on living animals. You know, short version, it's super hard, right? That's, you know, you think robots don't do what you want. You know, then you encounter the real thing, and it's like it's a different level of challenge. They're really very different projects in a sense. Mm-hmm. They have a lot in common in terms of motivation. But really one was this robotics project that drew inspiration from the termites, but to a limited extent. And the other one is really about understanding nature, you know, a more pure science kind of endeavor, where it may or may not wind up influencing the way we design future robot algorithms, but that's not the purpose of it. So the thing that makes us interested in both topics is the qualities they have in common of self-organization. So again, how do you program a large number of independent agents so that together they wind up doing an interesting or useful collective thing? And that's really a common theme that drives all of our work.
All right. Thanks, Justin, for being here with us on Robots.
Thanks, Sabine.
And that's all for today. As always, for more information, pictures, and videos, just check out our website at robotspodcast.com. Our next episode will air in 2 weeks' time. Until then, goodbye. Termites with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.